Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we'll dive into a suspenseful new film, Conclave, a modern-day thriller centered on the election of a new pope. According to our movie critic, Matt Olean, it has all the intrigue of an Agatha Christie mystery. Matt will join us in the studio to share his review a bit later in the show. And also later in the show, Dave Thompson and I will continue our Thursday tradition of discussing this week's top news stories. But first, we'll start with an exploration of the latest issue of Dakota Digital Review. Patrick McCloskey is the director of the Social and Ethical Implications of Cyber Sciences for the North Dakota University System, and he serves as editor-in-chief of the Dakota Digital Review. Patrick, welcome back to Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig. Thank you for having me.
We have another edition of the Dakota Digital Review to discuss. Before we get into that, remind us, what is the Dakota Digital Review?
The Dakota Digital Review is published by the North Dakota University System. It's the publication for all of the 11 colleges and universities in the North Dakota system, and it's really written for everybody in the state. It's written not geek to geek, we're covering technology, but it's written for the average reader to begin to understand AI, technology, you know, this big technological tsunami that's hitting us with generative AI and digitization, etc.
Stories about rural issues, about urban issues in every issue, Patrick?
I reach out to experts, both in North Dakota, throughout our university system, and outside. The idea of the publication was to go directly to people who know something, that have expertise, and work with them to write to the general public. So I use my journalistic background to do that. The only professional journalist I use other than myself occasionally is Mark Mills, although he's actually trained as a physicist. So, you know, anybody can write it and who wants to go through the process. In this issue, there's a grad student or law student who wrote an article. In the next issue, I'm actually starting to work with two high schoolers who actually wrote a paper about a technological paper and, you know, trying to see how we can configure that for this publication.
Certainly North Dakota centered, and the best news, it's free.
It is free.
How can people get at this issue, Patrick?
Well, they can look up Dakota Digital Review.
Google search it.
Yeah, Google search it, Dakota Digital Review. And it's a good thing to put the NDUS in, which means North Dakota University System. It's easy to find.
You can download it. It's free. It's also in publication. You'll see it around the state.
If you'd like to get on the mailing list, you can email me with a mailing address.
High school students can understand the topics that you cover, certainly, as can the farmer in his combine.
Absolutely.
It's written for everyone here in North Dakota. Mark Mills, you talk about, I didn't realize until you told me, he's been kind of the cover issue of every publication that you've generated.
Yeah, I started at the University of Mary with 360 Review. We covered all academic arenas, and Mark wrote in every issue of that publication. His areas of expertise are energy, robotics, manufacturing, the cloud, and so on. And I met Mark when we were on the board at the Riley Center at Notre Dame. He became a good friend. Also a Canadian expat, and he's been really gracious to write in every publication.
I've had conversations with my son who lives in Jamestown. They have a server farm that is just north of the community. You go by it, it looks like a bunch of storage containers, but inside of it is a massive number of servers, and the electrical requirements are just extreme. His cover story is called Unplugging Growth, AI, the Cloud, and Electricity Demands. What about this article?
The cloud sounds ephemeral, but it's actually, and it is in a sense that you know, we upload with wirelessly, et cetera, but the backbone of that are these data centers, which are a mess. I mean, they currently use twice as much electricity as the country of Japan. And to give a sense of scale, the one in Jamestown, it looks large, but the ones that are being built elsewhere, for example, in this issue of a photo of the what's called Switch SuperNAP 8, which is one of four or five this company has, they're building it out. When it's all done, it'll cover 90 acres.
And that's in Nevada.
And they have several in different parts of the country to sort of link up so they get less latency, which they count in nanoseconds, right?
Exactly, and it's important for some applications. But North Dakota, turns out, climate's pretty darn good for these server farms.
Well, they generate a lot of heat, so the cold is an excellent from that point of view. We have water up the Missouri, and also we have a lot of energy. So there's a big energy advantage to building data centers here, and there are big companies considering it at the moment.
So when you have an article like this in the Dakota Digital Review, Patrick, what do you hope people glean from it?
Well, I wanted to get a sense of the dimension of what's going on and the fact that there is a physical nature to it, and that North Dakota is positioned well to benefit by it, because if we can attract the data centers, we can also have less costly use of AI for universities and government, et cetera, and be competitive. Also to be aware of the growing potential conflict between AI energy demands, data center energy demands, and the energy demands of a growing economy and the consumer, that these you can project these forward, and the demands are far greater than anything that's being built now. So, you know, the sort of green thing can't possibly keep up with it. It's important, but it can't do all of that. And for people who worry about fossil fuels, well, we really need to get on with nuclear energy.
More articles that were very interesting to me, Patrick. The article is titled, "The Times They Are a Changin'." Boy, are they ever. AI's powerful winds sweeping across higher ed. You work in higher ed, Patrick, and this article talks a lot about how AI is used, you know, in higher education today and what it means.
Well, everyone's grappling with exactly that. And as you might imagine, often it's, you know, students who are younger and more sort of native digital adapt quicker. So a lot of them are sort of, oh, great, ChatGPT and all these generative AI, I can help me do my work, right?
Or do my work.
Exactly. That's the crux of the problem right there. Is it assisting in a good way, or is it just taking over so that, you know, assignments and essays, etc., are basically done via prompt rather than reading and researching and thinking and all that sort of the sort of traditional process. And how do you know as an instructor whether or not someone is actually learning anything, right? So that's the big challenge. And you know, I think in many places they've been dragging their feet. They've been pretty good in North Dakota, and you know, the
article points out North Dakota may be ahead of the game a little bit in thinking about these topics.
Yeah. Well, the chancellor's been very big on that, Mark Hagerot, since he came in 10 years ago, that AI is going to change everything. So he's been pushing that. There are task forces. The article is written by Nick Datsoff. He's a law professor at UND, and he and professors there have been grappling with it. And they're trying to find a balance, because you're not going to get rid of these generative AIs. They're only going to get more powerful, and they're going to be of great help to everyone. And for people coming out of law school looking for a job, going at a law firm, yeah, they need to know these tools, but they have to evaluate that, right? Because pretty soon, if not now, you'll be able to, you know, if you want to, as a regular person, do a lot of legal stuff, you'll be able to maybe pay a subscription, go into an AI thing, and just get all the documents and everything, right? You don't need a lawyer. So on the one hand, if you're a lawyer, it's going to speed up a lot of stuff. On the other hand, you better know more than just prompting, right? So the demand on the education side is to make sure that, yeah, okay, people need to know this stuff, but they also better know themselves how to be really good lawyers and examine what AI is putting out and so on.
What I thought about in this regard is, sure, any student can use this to fake out a teacher and write a paper about anything, but that teacher, the instructor, the professor still retains the ability to test.
Exactly.
To test for knowledge, and therefore it can be a tool.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in law you can just, you know, give a paper and pencil test, or oral as well, right? I mean, obviously lawyers have to get up before the judge and so on and so forth. So there's still some pretty decisive ways of figuring out whether people learn or not. The challenge is actually to get the professors, all the professors on board with how to deal with this, and the curriculum rework, and the administrators. It's a whole turning of a big ocean liner.
Right? Yeah, that ocean liner is coming at speedboat speeds.
Exactly.
And we're having to deal with that. Other great articles that are inside this edition of Dakota Digital Review. Favorite of mine is, talks about intentional use of social media, written by Carrie Ann Platt, talking about, you know what, we can use social media, and here are some ways that might guide us into being more productive and healthy with it.
Exactly, and Carrie Ann is a professor of communications. She's also a vice provost for faculty affairs, and this is exactly what she teaches, and she has two middle school kids, right? So she's perfect person to write it because she deals with it personally and professionally. And so she's had, since it came out, she's been working with students and with her family. How do you take advantage of all the good things it provides, you know, information, entertainment when you need it, sort of thing, but avoid the addictive quality of the algorithms?
And she talks about the algorithms and how they try to lure you in.
Right, exactly. I mean, obviously, if you, any product that you produce as a company, you want people to come back, right? You don't make a lousy pizza if you want people to come back. You make a good pizza. So you, so it's very understandable to some extent, although there's a lot of probably dark things going on in the addictive side. But the effect on teenagers has been absolutely disastrous in the sense that a massive rise in pessimism, anxiety, depression, and so on that you can track with the introduction of TikTok and all of these things. You know, that people have been overboarding and not limiting it. And parents, of course, being broadsided, they don't know their children as necessarily on it, right? And there's been a lot of talk a lot about how negatively it's affecting girls, but in some of the data shows that boys are doing worse.
And that surprised me. There's a beautiful chart that explains that very well in this edition.
Yeah, in some charts, the girls are doing worse, but actually the boys have a sharper increase in the negatives.
Yeah, good advice, though, for any parent who's concerned about their middle schoolers or maybe their high schoolers. They're intentional, and I think that's a good word to use.
Right.
Use the tool intentionally to get value out of it, but don't let the tool use you.
Right. Well, she's got a lot of strategies, which I think is worth reading. You know, practical strategies. Okay, I get the idea. How do I do it? Well, she lays out the strategy.
She really does. Our agricultural friends are also included, as they are in every issue, it seems to me, of the Dakota Digital Review. This article is titled "The Fourth Agricultural Revolution, Unleashing AI and Community Innovation." Some interesting pictures that I want to learn more about.
You know, people don't necessarily know this, but Fargo is a world center for agriculture and agricultural innovation. And Graham Farm is at the forefront of what's called the fourth agricultural revolution. The third agricultural revolution, I think we're all familiar with, with the high crop varieties and better fertilizers, which have increased, and irrigation, which increased, the green revolution, basically. I mean, going back a couple of decades, they were predicting a famine, right, in the 70s or whatever. But this revolution, now we feed 8 to 9 billion people. Well, we're on the cusp of the fourth industrial revolution, which adds to that all that AI and autonomous vehicles bring to the table. And William Ederholt, who's the director of Graham Farm's, main point in the article is we have now this, it's almost like the cloud for agriculture in the sense that these local, regional, and global communities coming together to solve problems from various points of view. So you get, not just maybe people involved in fertilizer production having a conference. You know, Grand Farm is one place brings all of the different aspects of agriculture together. And so people get together, discuss the same problems. How can we work together? You got hundreds of startups, all the way up to other universities, all sort of collaborating, competing, figuring things out. Because we're onto the arena where the third agricultural revolution may have given a farmer what William calls one choice per field about how much fertilizer, et cetera, et cetera. Well, with AI, machine learning, with the surveillance from the drones, it's 10 decisions about, irrigation and the fertilizers, et cetera. Well, 10 per field, 100 per field, 1,000 per field. At some point, there'll be one per plant, many per plant. So we're talking massive increases in the processing of data and control. So less waste, less water, less pesticide, more yield.
More yield.
From the same, better sustainability.
Absolutely.
With no-till and all these other things. So, and recently they had some of the photos in this issue are from an autonomous nation event they had with all of these, robotic things that go in the field and do all sorts of things.
Moving on, Patrick. Patrick McCloskey, he's the editor-in-chief of the Dakota Digital Review, a publication of the North Dakota University System. This was an interesting read for me. And the title of the article is "The Need for Campus Climates Fueling Innovation." Patrick, I thought that's what our campuses were for.
They are.
Interesting interesting points in the article here.
Yeah, well, to be clear, no North Dakota institution is included in the survey. So it's a nationwide survey that the Challey Institute has been done for the last 4 years with College Pulse, and they're looking at student attitudes towards free speech, towards differing opinions about whether to report professors or other students if they say something offensive, about student attitudes towards major issues like capitalism, socialism, and so on. So they've been tracking this for 4 years, and there's kind of, on the surface, it might look like campuses are doing their job, but when you drill down a bit, there's a lot of illiberal attitudes have developed in recent years.
Very, very interesting read. Elections don't escape this issue, Patrick, and we had a turn of thought from the author here,
exactly,
thinking that maybe the blockchain was the answer. Turns out he believes maybe it isn't. What did we learn about the article titled Securing Elections with Blockchain, Back to the Future with, what?
Paper ballots. Yep. Marcus Fries, he's an assistant dean of cybersecurity at Bismarck State College, and his expertise is in math and cryptography. He's written before about cryptography. So I asked him about this. I said, well, you know, could blockchain secure elections? Obviously, securing elections is an issue. Could this settle it? And when he started researching for the article, he was firmly convinced it would settle it. But as he did the research, he realized, this is not going to work. It's, you know, things can be hacked. And there are a number of conditions that we would want about the verifiability of voters, et cetera, et cetera. So to take a step back, I suppose in theory you could do it, but it would be massively cumbersome from the security viewpoint to make it totally secure for every voter of, what, 180 million people who are going to vote. Would be way beyond any capacity that you know, you'd end up with 10 million people voting because it'd be so cumbersome. Plus, it could still be hacked. So he came to the conclusion that really we have a tried and true solution, which is paper ballots, which can be audited, which can, you know, we can verify.
It can be voter, machine counted and then
machine counted, and audited. But then you can audit the machine if you have something to back it up, right? So if somebody says, well, this doesn't seem right for whatever reason, the machine might have miscounted it, well, we can do a paper count.
AI dominates a lot of what is included in the Dakota Digital Review, Patrick, and will AI replace inventors? Made me think about that question. I mean, shoot. Hello, ChatGPT. I want X. Build it for me. Tell me how to build it, and then I'm done with my inventing for the day.
Right. Well, to some extent, that'll work. It's like anything else. On the one hand, you can get a solution or you can get 50 solutions. Which is the best? Does it really work? And I think it's like anything else. It's, you know, yeah, I'm a writer. If I say, okay, I haven't really done much in ChatGPT, but I would know whether something is well written. And if it's in an area I know something about, I would also know whether it's actually telling the truth or hallucinating. But if you don't have a certain level of expertise in the first place, you're not going to know. You're kind of captured by it. I think there, you know, I think, now this is someone, Noel Anderson, he worked at Deere for a long time. He has 204 patents, 54 pending. And every day I talk to him, no, it's 205 or whatever, you know, it's changing every day. Uh-huh. And, you know, he writes a very somewhat technical but in-depth article about AI and the math and all that sort of thing. To say that at the moment, AI can assist innovation, but there are elements to it that escape quantitative computation. Like just the article is, you know, the subtitle is computing versus seeing. There's a human component that we really can't replace. Seeing a need, bringing the human part of ourselves to the equation. And there are, so it's like the difference between quantitative and qualitative. You know, it can really help replace no.
Brings me back to a question we had in a second semester calculus class on whether the can of tuna was the most efficient way to store tuna on the shelf. And we decided that it wasn't, but if it was stored in something that didn't look like a tuna can, then would anyone buy it, right? And so the human aspect of all is certainly,
exactly,
certainly a part of this. Relative to digital sovereignty in localized data centers, something I had not thought about at all, it's an issue.
Well, it is, because you know, as we upload and our data, and I'm not talking just personally, governments are doing, university systems, and it's been an issue in North Dakota. In fact, the Mark Hagroth, the chancellor, has been involved in this, saying, look, we need to have our data stored in North Dakota for North Dakota instead of depending on one of these big server companies like Amazon or whatever. Well, what if they start objecting to some policy that's in North Dakota and you know, close off our data or
hold it hostage or
hold
something
it hostage
like that.
Mm-hmm. Or if they get attacked, they're a big target. Well, if we have control of it here, we have the, you know, not only legislative control, but we can install a higher level of security than they have. And but the other side of it is, of course, you know, it's a lot less expensive to let the big boys do it, and it's easier to scale. You know, like let's say if a company started in North Dakota and you want to scale it across the country or globally, really a lot easier to do with the big services, right? So you've got this sort of how do you balance those two? It's not necessarily an either or. I would say it seems common sense to say, well, for really vitally important data, perhaps local storage and higher security, other stuff, you know, we could think about using Alibaba or Google Cloud or whatever.
Sure. Sure. If Amazon Web Services.
Yeah, if it's appropriate. But you know, we have to, you know, depending on our situation, we have to make that choice. But I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, state stuff that we're better off here.
Finally, this issue of Dakota Digital Review wraps up with a question: how AI is stealing our autonomy?
Right.
Is it making decisions now for us that we should be making ourselves?
Well, that's the danger, right? I mean, and, you know, we all kind of lived through it years ago with calculators coming in, where people. I mean, I remember being in New York and had a cashier, and the total came to $14.95, and the cashier pulled out a calculator to figure out the change when I gave her $15.
I didn't want to hear that.
Well, but it's just like, and it wasn't that it was a stupid person. It just became so routine to outsource one's thinking. Didn't even think about it, right? And that's kind of underlies all of this. What is human autonomy? I mean, the article written by Dennis Cooley, who's a professor of philosophy and ethics at NDSU, and you know, he's really thinking through these things, and he does teach ethics for engineers and all that sort of thing. So what is human autonomy? What is human decision making? And again, AI can help in certain regards, right? Like you could ask AI about information about a decision you have to make or alternatives, but if you just outsource this, then you're losing what is most precious to you. It's our decision making, it's our free will, it's our ability to think for ourselves. And also, he makes the point that even with the sorts of things we do, which could be called, you know, automatic sort of thinking, like so many things with decisions that we make that we've built up through our education and training and experience, we just do automatically. We could stop and reflect on it, but we build everything on that. And it's not merely calculation. There's emotion, there's context, there's history, there's all sorts of components there. And the same with new decision in a new environment. We automatically bring in, especially if it involves human beings, you know, things like charity, mercy,
empathy,
and so on, into a decision. And you know, we have to sort of maintain that in our personal lives, but also maintain that in our public life. You know, for example, if a judge has to decide on sentencing, do we want some AI algorithm to figure out, given all the data about that person, how many years in prison or whether they should go out on parole, et cetera, et cetera? Well, the AI can help us with pattern recognition and so on and aggregate data, but it ultimately should be a human decision about a human being. Otherwise, we don't have a human society.
Patrick McCloskey, he's the director of the Social and Ethical Implications of Cyber Sciences at the North Dakota University System, and he serves as the editor-in-chief of Dakota Digital Review. One more time, Patrick, how can people download and read for free this current edition?
We can get it online at Dakota Digital Review and include NDUS in there so that it'll come up easily. On the webpage, you can read it for free. You can download the PDF. You can go to Dakota Digital Review. It's on the left-hand side. There's an intro by me, Patrick McCloskey. My email address is there. You can email me with questions, suggestions, if you want to write, or just get a physical copy.
And it is written for laymen. Even people like me can understand
it,
Patrick.
Even people like me can understand. If I can understand it, you can. So.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, an intense review of the movie Conclave. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
with the fanfare, that means one and only one thing. It means it's Thursday here on Main Street, and we're at the movies with our good friend Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Matt, the movie this week is Conclave. Let's listen to the trailer, and then let's talk about the show.
The Pope is dead.
The throne is vacant.
What happened?
They say a heart attack.
You know how rumor spreads and 1.25 billion souls watching.
Well gotten, Lawrence.
It seems the responsibility for the conclave falls upon you.
The supervision of this election is a duty I never thought I'd have to perform. They are sequestered, and they must be shielded from all news that may influence their judgment. You understand?
No sane man would want the papacy.
The men who are dangerous are the ones who do want it.
That sounds ominous.
I wonder if I could have a word in private.
You look anxious.
Everything under control.
How has this been kept a secret for so long?
We'll never find a candidate who doesn't have any kind of black mark against them.
Although we sisters are supposed to be invisible, God has nevertheless given us eyes and ears.
You should be careful, Thomas.
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. Matt, is this a war? Was it a war or was it a process? This sounds like it's an intense movie to me.
It is intense. One of my favorites of the year. I think it's going to be right in there come Oscar time, pitching in a lot of categories. Picture, director, Edward Berger, lead actor, Ralph Fiennes, probably some supporting people get nominated, I think. I really like this one a lot. It doesn't overstay its welcome in terms of the length of the movie. It's based on a 2016 novel by Robert Harris, and the basic plot, pretty simple, is the Pope dies. Okay. And there is a, you know, the cardinals have to meet to elect the new pope. And the person in charge of, you know, organizing the meeting and the voting is Ralph Fiennes as Cardinal Lawrence. And he is torn on what to do. He has to carry out the duties of, you know, it's like an election. So if you go to this movie, it's going to feel like what we just went through, you know, except there's this room of cardinals and they vote for various cardinals that they think will be the next pope. And I would say it's like an Agatha Christie mystery set inside the Vatican, Craig. There's a mystery going on as to who the candidates are, what their baggage is, and Ralph Fiennes becomes kind of this listener, talker, investigator, trying to figure out who is the best person to take over as Pope. He doesn't want the job. He's like morally ambiguous in terms of not wanting the job, even though he appears to be, as you watch the movie, maybe the guy who's best suited for the job. And so a lot of people, Stanley Tucci plays a cardinal who does not want the job, but Ralph Fiennes wants him to be the next pope. Sergio Castellitto, really good performance by him as a more conservative cardinal who badly wants the job. John Lithgow plays another cardinal who badly wants the job. But they all have little secrets and mysteries. And these things pop up. There's another cardinal who shows up at the voting. Carlos Diaz plays Cardinal Benitez, who's a cardinal that's kind of been in Baghdad and Middle East and kind of, you know, really doing ministry work in some bad places. And he's an interesting character, too. So it's really this kind of election, who's going to be elected. And it's a mystery, too, because a lot of little things pop up. In terms of what is this person's past, what's going on with this person, and Ralph Fiennes tries to manage it all. His performance reminds me a little of Paul Scofield in A Man for All Seasons, the great 1966 Oscar-winning film about Sir Thomas More, as he's trying to navigate this morally crazy road to elect a new pope. So the cinematography is great. It's very dark. You feel like you're set in kind of a claustrophobic confines of these hushed rooms in the Vatican, and I liked it a lot. It's you know, there's not a lot of action in it, but like I say, it's a 2-hour mystery, as It's almost like Ray Fiennes has all these people in the same room, you know, at the end of an Agatha Christie, and they determine who did it. And that's kind of how it feels. And I liked it a lot. I think it's going to be pitching right in there for a lot of Oscars and Oscar nominations. Isabella Rossellini plays a nun. She has a very key role in the movie as well. So lots of familiar actors and actresses in this. And I would definitely go out and see this movie.
Matt, this setting is modern day. Does that add to or take away from the mystery and the suspense of the movie?
It's good that it's set in modern day, because one of the things going on in the movie is, where does the church go from here? Okay, the Pope is dead. We don't learn too much about the Pope and what he did, but there are conservative members of the College of Cardinals, and there are more liberal members of the College of Cardinals who want the church to move in a more liberal direction, which is where, you know, Pope Francis is trying to take it right now. And that's why I think this is the movie of the moment to go see, no matter what side you're on. But I do think that the modern issues that the Catholic Church continues to wrestle with, and I'm not Catholic, so I'm going to, you know, divorce myself from that, are at play here in this movie. You know, where is the new Pope going to take this church? Are women going to be ordained? You know, these issues all pop up in this movie, and you know, whoever they elect is going to be, you know, have his finger on the pulse of where the church goes. So I like that it's set in a modern setting, and it feels more like you're watching an election, like you're watching monumental decisions to the future of this church.
Matt, does the movie feel like it's accurate? Do you feel that they did not take liberties with this film to sensationalize it?
So it's a novel. So there are some, you just wonder what conversations really are going on at the College of Cardinals when a new pope is elected. I don't know. No one will ever know. I do think there's probably some liberties taken with dialogue and things like that, but that's okay. It's based on a novel, and it's supposed to do that in terms of making it more interesting. And let me just call out Ralph Fiennes. Ralph Fiennes in this movie has, you know, three or four really big scenes, but he does a lot of listening. It's one of these listening performances, investigative performances, and he's a wonderful actor, as you know, two-time Oscar nominee. Some people think this is his Oscar to lose. And it's a great performance. I do think he's probably a slight favorite. We'll have to see if the Bob Dylan biopic with Timothée Chalamet comes off. That could be his stiff competition for Best Actor. But right now, it'd be great to see him win an Oscar, because he should have won for Schindler's List long ago.
Matt, you talk about how this film is really almost a mirror to today's political complexities that we're all a part of. Do you feel that the movie was genuine in the way it portrayed those political complexities?
In terms of based on the novel, I would say there has been pushback from the Catholic Church on this movie. I was kind of checking some things out online. One Catholic bishop referred to it as, if you want to go to a movie where the New York Times editorial board is going to write a movie about the Catholic Church, this is probably your movie. So that was a harsh review. But again, that's from people within the Catholic Church that might think the film leans too far to the left, possibly, on what kind of Pope Ralph Fiennes wants to see elected as in his role as you know, setting up this conclave of cardinals. So it'll depend on your point of view, Craig. I would say going into this, if you're a conservative Catholic, the film might not quite check the boxes for you. I would say that, but go in with an open mind, because you know, there's a lot of people vying for this spot in the conclave.
Any religious movies that compare in one way or another to this film?
Well, I mentioned A Man for All Seasons, and I think that's the film that is reminiscent of this. A very different film in terms of, you know, Sir Thomas More. If you've seen that movie, Craig, he opposes Henry VIII's divorce, who wants a divorce, and it results in Thomas More, you know, being beheaded at the end of the film. And Paul Scofield wins the Oscar for Best Actor as kind of the guy in the room who has morals. And I sense that Ralph Fiennes is that guy in this movie, too. He's the face of integrity, trying to guide the College of Cardinals to pick the right pope. So that's the religious movie it most reminded me of. And that's one of my favorite movies, by the way, A Man for All Seasons. It's so good. But I mean, it's a little different than that, but it did remind me a bit of that, with kind of the political intrigue and the mystery going on inside these walls.
All right, Matt, what else is coming down the line for us before we get to Oscar trivia?
The big weekend is November 22nd, when Wicked and Gladiator 2 both hit the same weekend. There are hopes within the movie industry this will be this year's Barbenheimer, where people will go to Wicked and do a double feature and watch Gladiator 2. The initial buzz on Gladiator 2 is really good. I don't know if any critics have seen Wicked yet. The jury is out on Wicked. It could be really good. It could be one of these great musical adaptations like West Side Story and Oliver were years ago. Or it might be a big miss. I'm just not sure about the casting in Wicked as well, but we'll see. Those are the two big ones coming.
We'll look forward to those, Matt. All right, time for our Oscar trivia moment. This is a religious movie that won 11 Academy Awards in 1960. You already know the answer.
Ben-Hur.
Is that one of your favorite pictures, too, of all time?
No, I think Ben-Hur is overrated a bit. It's basically a one-scene movie, The Chariot Race, which is amazing. But some of it is kind of slow and slack, I think. And I think compared to Lawrence of Arabia, in terms of epics of that time, Lawrence of Arabia is the far superior movie.
Why was it so successful that year relative to the Oscars?
It was a big, big budget, huge thing. It had great art direction. You know, the Chariot Race was amazing. It just caught the public fancy that year, I guess. But I think over time, the film's reputation has suffered a little bit over the years. I don't think it deserved all 11 Oscars. Certainly not Hugh Griffith as supporting actor who won that for basically showing Charlton Heston the horses.
We've been to the movies as we do each and every Thursday with our great movie critic, Matt Olien. Matt, thank you so much.
You bet.
Extra, extra, read all about. Gather round, everybody.
There's the Thursday music that we hear when it's time to review the news with our news director here at Prairie Public. That, of course, is Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Craig. About you?
I'm doing well, Craig. Thank you very much. Lots going on this week. Certainly the election was here in North Dakota and across our country. Let's start with Governor-elect Kelly Armstrong. Dave, what will Kelly Armstrong's election mean to North Dakota? Have you thought about that?
I have thought about it, and one thing, and it combines something else that you talked about. He is bound and determined to do something about property taxes. I interviewed him on election night, and he said job number one is property taxes. And Katie interviewed him, and he said, look, we're working on plans to do something with property taxes, given the fact that Measure 4 went down. So, and he said he was going to do it whether or not it went down. So if it passed, he was going to be working on some legislation on it. So we'll have to see what he rolls out. He is, of course, a former legislator, which means he'll get along well with the legislature. And it's no secret that Governor Doug Burgum, who wasn't in the legislature, did have some times where he had some friction with members of the legislature. So it could be a very interesting legislative session coming up in January.
As I chatted with Rick Becker yesterday, he was a proponent of Measure 4, of course. Perhaps if there's a silver lining in light of its defeat, it's that now the message perhaps is there for the legislature and for Governor-elect Kelly Armstrong to now deal with this property tax problem, I'll say, here in North Dakota.
Absolutely. And one thing that the governor-elect also said is that rebates from state government are not going to cut it. He said we'd have to do more to get to the root causes of what the issue is, why people are seeing their property tax bills go up.
Dave, there potentially could be two demand recounts relative to legislative races here in the state. What is a demand recount and who is it impacting?
An automatic recount will happen when a candidate fails to be elected with 0.5% or less than the highest vote getter. The demand recount is possible when a candidate has failed by 2% or less. Now, what happens in a demand recount, the candidate making the challenge has to pay for it. With an automatic recount, which none of the races were that close, then it would be up to the state to do the recount. But we've got two House districts where there is a potential for this demand recount. And one, of course, is District 9, where Colette Brown defeated David Bryan. Collette's a Democrat, David is a Republican, by about 35 votes in that district. Then you go to District 18, which is Grand Forks, and that was about a little bit more than, because it's a large district, you have somebody who has 65 votes, Nels Christensen, who has defeated Mary Adams. Nels is a Republican, Mary is a Democrat, so she could ask for a demand recount.
I'm guessing time is of the essence, and they must do that within a specified period of time, Dave?
Well, here's the deal. There is going to be a meeting of the county canvassing boards on November 18th. The canvassing boards will then send the results to the state canvassing board, which meets on the 20th of November. And after that is when they can ask for these demand recounts.
Dave, the Secretary of State has said that more people voted early than voted on Election Day. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
It is neither. It just basically means people still are engaged and going out to vote. He says just voting habits are changing in the state because people can't maybe get out of off of work on Election Day, so they are voting earlier. They're using the mail-in voting. They're using the voting centers when they're possible. And, you know, it has impacted the fact that less people are voting on Election Day. He says that may be a trend in other states as well.
Dave, let's bend away from election news. We'll certainly cover the fallout of the election in weeks to come. I know your news department will for sure. So we'll look forward to the legislature coming back to work in December to get ready for next year.
For what is known as the organizational session. And that's where Governor Burgum will present his final budget recommendation to that organizational session. Armstrong becomes governor on the 15th. So Armstrong will not get a chance to put his own budget together, but he says he's been in contact with Burgum's office and they'll just tweak some things when they get into legislative session. I think the budget address is scheduled for December 4th.
Dave, let's talk about other news that's happening in North Dakota. There's a task force now that has recommended allowing childcare in schools in an effort to recruit and retain teachers.
Right. Recruiting employees, teachers and other employees, seems to be, you know, hampered by a lack of childcare. So what they want to do is change the rules so that if there's a classroom in a school that is not being used, maybe you could use that for on-site daycare for teachers and their kids. Now, that's a pretty good idea, but there are certain districts, for example, West Fargo, where they're really crowded. They don't have the room. But the West Fargo school board member I talked to said that she thinks it's a great idea because in areas where they do have a room in their school for maybe a classroom or two that might be empty, this is a good way to keep teachers and to recruit new teachers.
Dave, keeping on the education topic, Fargo school superintendent has announced that he's going to resign.
Yeah, he's resigning at the end of the school year. That's going to be next year. And he said he did this, so now this is, he said that he's doing it now because he gives the school board a chance then to conduct a search and, you know, go through the due diligence of the search. So he's saying, now I'm going to tell you I'm going to resign, and I'm going to resign at the middle of next year, and now you can find somebody else to do it.
And we're talking about, of course, Superintendent Dr. Rupak Gandhi.
Very well-respected around North Dakota. He's won some Superintendent of the Year awards. You know, there's going to be probably some big shoes to fill for the Fargo School District, but he has said that he is going to stay in Fargo and has got a new business that he wants to do. It looks like a consulting-type business.
Dave, North Dakota's tourism director is trying to up the state's game when it comes to winter tourism.
Right. Now, that was interesting when we talked about this, Sarah Audick Holman, the tourism director, and I. She said, North Dakota's doors don't shut when the weather gets cold. We have snowmobiling, we have some ski sites, and we're trying to promote the fact that, hey, you know, come and, you know, use these winter, you know, you do some cross-country skiing perhaps, or use the ski sites, or maybe just go out for a hike if the weather's good enough. That North Dakota is not closed for the winter.
Sure, Dave. And of course, we're going to have a winter just like last winter when it's going to be warm enough and no snow. So we'll be able to get out every day, right?
I think you're right. Yes.
Dave, what else are you and your team working on as we kind of get away from the election and work our way towards the holidays?
Well, here's what we are working on. There's an energy summit going on right now in Fargo, hosted by the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber. We're covering that. Also got some stories as the Public Service Commission gets back into the swing of things after the election. They're going to be talking about some natural gas rate increases. They're going to be talking about that proposed carbon dioxide pipeline that still has to be resolved. So there's going to be a lot on the plate that way.
Dave Thompson and I review the news each and every Thursday here on Prairie Public. Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Craig.
Gather around, everybody.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hear the past come to life on Dakota Datebook 5 times a day, Monday through Friday, on Prairie Public. We tell North Dakota's story one colorful character at a time. Dakota Datebook, your daily dose of North Dakota history on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for November 7th. The United States nearly doubled in size with the Louisiana Purchase. The staggering purchase price of $15 million was actually a bargain, as it amounted to about 4 cents per acre. Once the purchase was finalized, the next question was, what did the United States actually buy? President Thomas Jefferson tasked Meriwether Lewis with exploring the land west of the Mississippi to the Pacific Ocean. Lewis chose William Clark as his co-leader. The Corps of Discovery set off from Camp Du Bois outside of St. Louis, Missouri on May 14, 1804. It would be 2 years before they returned. The company endured many hardships. There was a tense encounter with the Teton Sioux near what is now Pierre, South Dakota. They left their mark in North Dakota when they constructed Fort Mandan as a winter encampment. Setting out in the spring, they relied on guidance from Native Americans and fur traders to find their way. The trip was grueling. It took over a month to portage their gear 18 miles around the Great Falls in what is now Montana. They got lost in the snow and almost starved until they were taken in by the Nez Perce Indians. They paddled their dugout canoes down the treacherous Columbia River. On this date, in 1805, Clark recorded the great joy in camp as the company thought they were in sight of the Pacific Ocean at last. Clark wrote of the roaring or noise made by the waves breaking on the rocky shores. To their dismay, the members of the company were not looking at the Pacific Ocean. They were looking at a small estuary 20 miles away from it. It took them another 2 weeks to finally stand on the ocean shore. After a cold winter in camp, the company set out to return to civilization. They arrived in St. Louis in September 1806 and were welcomed as heroes. The expedition opened the door for westward expansion, but also had unforeseen consequences. The land purchased by the United States was inhabited by thousands of Native Americans belonging to dozens of tribes. As more and more people from the East made their way into what they saw as uninhabited areas, they displaced those who were already living there. The federal government forced the tribes onto reservations. The Lewis and Clark expedition ultimately set off decades of conflict. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Ari Shapiro from NPR. If working from home is your new routine and you've got a car you don't need anymore, consider donating it to this station. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose Vehicle Donation.
The president-elect is a billionaire. So is at least one of his cabinet choices and his most famous supporter.
Let me tell you, we have a new star. A star is born, Elon.
Who spent millions to elect him, so what's in it for Elon Musk? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We're deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Patrick McCloskey, editor of the Dakota Digital Review. The Review is a publication that explores cyber sciences and their societal, ethical, legal, and cultural impacts, written in a language that can help us all make critical decisions about technology's role in our collective and personal futures. Plus, Matt Olien will review the movie Conclave. It already has a lot of Oscar buzz. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll be with us.